Hello and welcome to this special edition of Brussels Unplugged. Today we have a very special guest, the former rockstar minister of finance from Greece, Yanis Varoufakis, the leader of DiEM25 and the author of Techno-Feudalism. Welcome, Yanis. Hello, Matteo. Welcome back to everybody.
Hello, Pietro.
And yes, today is a special edition. Please.
Well, hello, Pietro. Thank you for the introduction, even though I have to tell you that every time the media referred to me as a rock star minister, that was simply symbolic of a campaign not to be heard, because I only accepted the position of minister in order to get a job done. And it was part of the campaign of making sure that job would never be done. To portray me as something I'm not. I'm not a rock. I wish I were a rock star, but I'm not. just for the record.
No, thank you. Thank you, absolutely. Well, you always, not always, but you definitely have some very, very strong ideas that go against the mainstream, and you say things that, in my opinion, need to be said. For example, in your book on techno-feudalism, in which you call out our modern global economy for not being capitalistic anymore, but really to have moved to a techno-feudalism. Can you tell us a bit in your own words about this, and as well what was that moment that you realized that we live in a techno-feudal society and not that we're moving away from a capitalistic society and Yes, please.
Well, Pietro, before I get down to techno-feudalism, let me remind you that when in 2015 I was putting forward what you refer to as strong positions, effectively what I was warning the Eurozone and the European Union was that if we continue along the road of austerity for the many and money printing or socialism for the very few, Europe would end up stagnating. The German industrial model would be kaput very soon. And Europe will become geostrategically irrelevant. And this is exactly where we are now. And it's not because I was a prophet, but because it was bleedingly obvious that this was what was going to happen. Turning now to the techno-feudal hypothesis. I know that my book is controversial because of the subtitle. The title is Techno-Feudalism, the subtitle, What Killed Capitalism? And it is clearly controversial and to many outrageous, because it is true that wherever we look, every time, you know, wherever you turn your eyes or your ears, what you see is a triumph of capital. Capital has triumphed all over the globe, in our neighborhoods, inside our bodies, with the commodification of our genes, the commodification of women's bodies, the commodification of the stars and asteroids. Think of the Luxembourg market, where you have futures being traded for asteroid minerals. My goodness. So, yes, there is a complete triumph of capital. So why am I talking about the end of capitalism or capitalism having already been killed? Well, because capital became so triumphant that it mutated into a new form. Like, you know, viruses mutate and become more toxic occasionally. Capital was so successful, so triumphant, that it mutated into a new form of capital, which I call cloud capital. It's a kind of capital that lives inside your phone, your tablet, in the cloud, so to speak, even though it's not a cloud, it's optic fiber cables, it's server farms, it's algorithms, it's cell towers, and so on, so very material stuff. So my hypothesis is that this cloud capital is a very new type of capital, which is so toxic that it killed off its host, and its host being capitalism. And to just make a little bit more sense of that, now, we have to define our terms, of course, right? Scientifically, what do I mean by capitalism? Well, capitalism is a socioeconomic mode of production that sprang out of feudalism. Under feudalism, it was land ownership that conferred power on the owners of land, on the landed gentry. And what was the power? It was the power to extract the rents from the peasants, from the artisans, from the rest of society. And the great cathedrals were simply a manifestation of that wealth that accumulated as a rent rent extracted by the feudal lords who owned the land. With capitalism, the focus of power shifted from owning land to owning machinery, to owning electricity grids, telephone poles, more recently, the internet-based big tech companies. And so instead of rents being the foundation of wealth accumulation through the marketization and commodification of land, the commodification of capital, the commodification of everything, and labor, of course, you had profit. Profit as opposed to rent, a very different category. And now what I began to sense about 5-6 years ago happening is a new transformation. So we went under feudalism from land to capital, under capitalism to now what I call cloud capital. And cloud capital has replaced the two pillars of capitalism, the two pillars being of capitalism being markets and profits, and they have been replaced by digital fiefdoms, digital platforms, and profits have been replaced by the rents that the Jeff Bezoses and the Zuckerbergs and the Googles and so on extract from capitalists as well as from the rest of society. And that is no longer capitalism. I conclude by saying, well, welcome to techno-feudalism.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis, of course, also going back to what you foreseen already years ago when you were in your functions also as a minister. You said that you foreseen something now is happening with this techno-feudalism and capitalism. You mentioned, of course, the digital tech giants, and the EU and European Union has been sort of debating how to face these new economies, whether to impose more regulation, which it seems what it's doing, or rather leave it more to a free market, what the US and other powers are doing. How do you see now the policies of the European Union, of the new commission that is going to enter into force in a couple of months? How do you see now facing these new economic digital challenges?
It is a splendid combination of systematic idiocy and irrelevance. But allow me to, before I get to that, to say that in 2015, when I was a minister, I didn't foresee techno-feudalism. That would be far-fetched. I didn't. What I foresaw was that the combination of austerity for the majority of Europeans and money printing, huge liquidity for the financiers and and big business, that combination would bring about stagnation. That it was already bringing about, since 2009, 2010, an investment strike. That there would be no investment in Europe. We haven't had investment in Europe for 17 years. A total investment collapse. While in the United States and in China, the money printed by the Federal Reserve and the surpluses accumulating in China were heavily invested in this new form of capital, which I call cloud capital. So the result is that Europe has zero cloud capital, precisely zero. We don't have any of it. And it's all concentrated in China and in the United States. And that's the new Cold War between the United States and China, which has left Europe completely behind. So in Europe, we did not invest in traditional industries, in green technologies, in green energy, or in cloud capital. So we have become the stupid continent of the world, so we are irrelevant. And you have the pathetic Ursula von der Leyen, like a King Canute, ordering the tide to go back by the sheer power of her will. It won't go back. The idea, which you mentioned in your question, that Europe will regulate cloud capital when it has no cloud capital, is, as I said, it is a very sad reflection on the irrelevance and orchestrated idiocy in Brussels and off Brussels. How can you regulate an industry which you do not possess? There is zero possibility that Google and Apple and Meta and Uber and Airbnb and Tesla will be regulated by an unelected cabal of technocrats in Brussels who do not represent even the public opinion in Europe, in a continent which possesses not one worthy competitor of those businesses. a Europe in which you know, even the Chancellor of Germany is voting against, let's say, for instance, you know, hefty tariffs on electric vehicles being imported by from China, and still this passes as if there is some kind of consensus in Europe to do so. So I very much fear that after 15 years of an inane handling of the inevitable euro crisis, Europe has become, as I said, the sick continent of the world.
Thank you, Yanis. Then the next question that really just pops straight into mind, what's the way forward? Is there a way forward? What's the positive angle? Let's do a bit of a Fanta Politica, how we call it in Italy. Imagine, what would be a way forward?
Well, there's always a way forward. Not necessarily one that we like, but there are no cul-de-sacs in politics. There's always a solution. The question is, who are the political agents that are going to bring it about? Now, Pietro, if you asked me, let's say 5-6 years ago, that the same question, I would have pointed out to the Green New Deal for Europe that DiEM25, our movement, put forward in the European Parliament elections back then in 2019. It was a very comprehensive policy document, and one that I strongly believed back then could be the way forward. I still believe that had it been implemented, had it been adopted, it would have brought about a totally different Europe, a more dynamic Europe, a Europe that is relevant. It was not adopted. The main plank of that policy document, the Green New Deal for Europe, back in 2019, was the idea of a massive aggregate investment plan for, piling money into green energy, the green economy, the green transition, and the digital technologies that we never invested in. And the idea was 5% of European income going into this. Back then, we could do it. Back then, however, our policy was dismissed by the powers that be. Today, I notice, since you seem to be of an Italian persuasion, that, my old friend Mario Draghi has come out with his Draghi report, which is belatedly 6 years too late, in my view, advocating exactly the same, 5%, the same number, 5% of European income going into green technologies, and money that should be raised through common debt instruments, exactly as we foresaw and proposed 6 years ago. The tragedy is that whereas that was possible and feasible 6 years ago, it no longer is. Draghi doesn't answer the question where will, you know, what exactly will these debt instruments be? They cannot be bonds issued by the European Commission along the lines of what they did to fund the terrible, terrible, awful, ineffectual and toxic recovery fund. Next generation EU, whatever they call it. That can't be the case because the European Commission simply is not a reliable, it is not a creditworthy issuer of bonds simply because it doesn't have tax raising capacities and will never have them, as you can see from what's happening now in Berlin, in Paris and elsewhere. Our proposal back in 2019 was that the European Investment Bank issues the bonds to the tune of anything between 500 and 800 billion euros every year for the purposes of the green transition. The European Investment Bank can do it. It belongs to all European member states. With the backing of the ECB making the announcement that it will buy these bonds if needs be. That was our proposal back then. And I still think it was a splendid proposal. But that can't be done anymore because since 2019, we've had the pandemic and we had the inflationary bout, and the ECB has gone from a posture of buying bonds, like the ones that we proposed from the European Investment Bank, because of the deflationary period from 2010 all the way to 2020, to an inflationary posture or an anti-inflationary or disinflationary posture where now they are selling bonds, so they can't do that. And essentially what Draghi is suggesting can only be implemented today. I mean, what Draghi suggested was exactly what I suggested in 2019. But that now can only be implemented if you actually create a federal treasury, if Europe federates. But there's no discussion about that. So to answer your question in brief, epigrammatically, but succinctly and I think accurately, the way forward would be to federate. But that is not on the cards. Why? Because for the last 15 years, the Troika, the European Central Bank, the European Commission, the European Council, and so on, have done everything in their power to divide Europeans between North and South, and later on between East and West, so that there is absolutely no political process from which one can realistically see the federation that is absolutely necessary to prevent the slide of Europe into irrelevance and toxicity.
Thank you, Yanis. The next question that comes to mind, really, really stemming from what you just said, is that, and I share your view on federation, absolutely, especially in the more competitive geopolitical world that we're walking into, that's being developed even far away from Europe. If we think of the BRICS, which have been expanding in memberships and in its membership and its growth, bringing in even Iran and other wealthy players, but it seems to be having problems to get all of its actors on the same page, especially in regards towards de-dollarization and how to go about it. What are your thoughts? Do you see BRICS as a threat to the global monetary order, or do you see possibilities of complementarity between the more developed economies and the BRICS?
Well, there is no such thing as an international monetary order. It's the United States of America monopoly over payments. So let's be clear, right? It's not an international monetary order. It's an American dictatorial monopoly over payment systems. Let me remind you, just apropos of this question, of what happened when Donald Trump was elected. One of the very first things he did was to tear up an important and good agreement that the Europeans, the Americans, the Chinese, the Indians had brokered with Iran to end the isolation of Iran, to end the nuclear program of Iran. Obama was very much into it. He had told me himself that this was his number one priority in the last year of his presidency. That was a splendid agreement. The first thing Trump did was to tear it up. The day that he tore it up, Angela Merkel, who was then the all-powerful chancellor of Germany, came out with a statement that Germany will continue to honor the agreement with Iran and that German companies would continue to trade with Iranian companies, because as far as Europe was concerned, this agreement made sense and should continue. Let me remind you what happened within 6 hours. Within 6 hours, every major German conglomerate company, Siemens, BASF, Volkswagen, and so on, came out and contradicted Merkel and said, no, we are not going to trade with Iran because America doesn't let us. And why did they do that? They didn't have anything against their chancellor or against the agreement with Iran. No, but they feared being cut off from the American monopoly of payments and also from all the goodies that Trump was offering conglomerates from all over the world if they traded in the United States and they did as they were told. So essentially we have a planetary monopoly of transactions by the United States. Okay, so I need to make this point. This is not the BRICS versus the international monetary order of things. This is a challenge to the Americans' capacity to bully the Europeans as well as other people and bending everybody else to their will. The question now is, your question then is slightly edited and is transformed to, will the BRICS be able to counter that and create an alternative system? My answer to this, my attitude, if you want, regarding the BRICS, is that the BRICS are far more interesting and significant than the Anglo-Saxon press and politicians would have you believe. And at the same time, the BRICS are far less significant than what many people in the Global South would imagine it to be and hope that it is. It is not an alternative bloc to the United States and NATO. It is not coherent. You have as part of the BRICS, as you know very well, you have China and India, two countries who are almost at war with one another, and two countries where, you know, the United States is pushing Apple to relocate its factories from Shenzhen and China generally to India. There's a lot of political conflict between India and China. Russia and China do not see eye to eye to the extent that they would like to pretend that they do. You have Brazil that has its own agenda. It is certainly not interested in contradicting the United States, but it simply doesn't want to be totally, totally bullied and you know, bent to the will of Washington, D.C. Let me tell you what I think the fundamental problem is. The fundamental problem is one of macroeconomic imbalances within the BRICS. What they do share is, as I indicated before, they share a commitment to freeing themselves from the bullying power of the United States. That's what they all have in common, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, you know, very odd bedfellows. But the major problem they have is that China doesn't really want to take over the role of the dollar. Allow me to just put it as simply as that. And let me give you an example. After the sanctions that were imposed on Russia on energy exports, on oil and natural gas, Russia started buying a lot of stuff. Sorry, I'll say that again. Russia began to divert a lot of its energy, oil and natural gas, to India, for example. And he did this because it couldn't receive dollars for that, given the sanctions. It received a lot of rupees, you know, Indian currency. The problem is that Russia doesn't want to buy that much stuff from India. It wants to buy stuff from China. But will China accept the rupees that are accumulating in Moscow's banks? It would only want to do that if it needed to buy a lot of goods and services from India, but China doesn't. The only way you can progress from what they have decided in Kazakhstan to do now, which is to create an alternative to SWIFT, which allows them to make payments in national currencies. The only way of progressing from that to a common monetary system, not a common currency, but a common monetary system that replaces the dollar, is if China is prepared to make the yuan the backstop of the BRICS payment system. But the problem that the Chinese government has is opposition within China. Let me put it bluntly and rather provocatively, but I do believe it's accurate. The worst enemy of the yuan's internationalization, or to put it exactly in its reverse or inverse, the greatest supporter, ally of the US dollar dominance are Chinese capitalists. Because if you're a Chinese capitalist in Shanghai, let's say, and you have a factory producing aluminium, and you sell to the United States, some firm in California, right? Why are you managing to sell your aluminium to California? America is in a dreadful balance of payments deficit. The only reason why the United States can continue to buy the aluminium from Shanghai is because of the dominance of the dollar. The dominance of the dollar allows the United States to effectively print IOUs, called dollars, that they give to the aluminium producer in Shanghai. The aluminium producer in Shanghai takes these dollars, and what can he do with these dollars? He takes them back to New York and buys U.S. treasuries, in other words, funds the American government, or buys real estate in California or in Miami, or some shares that he's allowed, not many, because he's Chinese, right? So essentially, the money goes back to the United States. But the capitalist in Shanghai is accumulating huge amounts of dollar debt. He doesn't want to see the dollar be dethroned. So there's a lot of pressure within the Communist Party of China not to overthrow, not to test the limits of the US dollar. It only when Xi Jinping or, you know, the government in China, generally the authorities, decide that they want to confront their own capitalists and they want the yuan to play a purely antagonistic role to the American dollar, only then will a BRICS payment system become a true competitor and a true underminer of American monopoly when it comes to transactions. Now, the United States are very worried that that moment will come. This is why we have a huge, huge new Cold War unleashed, first by the Trump administration and then the Biden administration against China, which is jeopardizing world peace. It jeopardizes the future of ourselves and our children.
Thank you. Thank you, Yanis. I mean, listening to you is like having going to a university class. We can be here probably for hours debating economy. We know that, of course, your time is precious and it's not endless. So, and since this our podcast is, of course, called Brussels Unplugged, and you've never been in Brussels. I mean, even when you were a finance minister, you tried to avoid it. That's what you told us also before we start this recording. Of course, Brussels, even metaphorically, plays a big role in national governments, the relationship between national governments and the European Union. It was almost 10 years ago that you were a finance minister in a very delicate moment for your country, for Greece. What do you remember about Brussels meant indeed, not just as the city itself, but really the place where decisions were taken for Greece, and decisions are still taken for many member states that do not always align, to be mild, let's say, do not always align with the will of the people, with the will of the elected government. So what's your relationship with Brussels? What do you think about it in all senses?
Well, during the 6 months I was Minister of Finance in 2015, I spent most of my time in Brussels, but I didn't see Brussels at all because I was in these awful neon-lit rooms in the buildings of the European Union, spending countless hours struggling to gain the right to negotiate, negotiating for the right to negotiate, something I never succeeded in doing. My nice memories about Brussels stem from a period before that. After that, I have to tell you, maybe because of the trauma of those endless nights of negotiations about negotiations, I don't think I've been to Brussels more than once or twice, and always just in and out, just to get to give a speech or to go to a meeting, to go to a theater on one occasion, and then I was out. But allow me to say that the abiding memory I have of those 6 months is the opacity of decision making in Brussels. Most citizens of the European Union believe that inside these large rooms with the round tables or the rectangular tables where the ministers sit and the prime ministers and presidents also congregate, that there is intense technical discussion leading to decision making. It's not my experience. My experience was that before you enter those rooms, the decisions had already been made in some dark recess of those buildings by unknown personalities. And then we would spend 10 hours, literally spend 10 hours, negotiating the wording of the communique, not the essence of the policies that wrecked Europe and jeopardized the living standards of 500 million Europeans. This opacity is, I think, the greatest shame and lost opportunity, because whenever you have opaque decision-making, when you don't even know who has decided what and what was the rationale, the result is decline and fall. In the United States, whatever the demerits of the American system, and goodness gracious me, there are many, at least you know who is deciding what and for what reason. So after the 2008 collapse of the financial system of Wall Street, there was a meeting. The president was there, George W. Bush, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the representatives of the big banks, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and so on, and they sat around the room and they asked a simple question: how are we going to save ourselves from this Armageddon? So you know what happened, and you know what they decided. In Europe, you have no idea what exactly was talked about. It's much more likely that they sat around a large table and they asked themselves the most idiotic of questions: how can we pretend that our rules still apply when they clearly don't apply? It's not the same question as the Americans asked. So since you're asking me to reflect on Brussels, I think the happiest memory I have from Brussels in the last few years, well, actually there were two. One was much, much before I was a minister, when my wife, Danai Stratu, who is the serious person in this family, an artist, put on an exhibition of an installation in Brussels, and I spent a month there with her while she was putting it up. And that was very pleasant. And the second happy memory I'm going to leave you with was when DiEM25, we had a great event at the Bazaar to launch our 2019 campaign. And it was a very pleasant evening with lots of different comrades. We even had Julian Assange beam in from the Ecuadorian embassy where he was incarcerated back then.
Well, those were really nice memories that we also share. We have been living much longer in Brussels, Pietro, as well, about, you know, culture, about art exhibitions. But we also share sometimes that feeling of opacity of the institutions, and definitely those neon lights that they are mainstream in all the EU institutions. No, Pietro?
Those lights are absolutely atrocious. It feels like you're in the hospital waiting for an operation. And you're about to be knocked out, but Brussels does have nice things. I do like my life here. And Yanis, I do hope that one day you'll come to Brussels and we'll be able to give you more nice memories. But before we leave each other today, it's time for our unplugged recommendations. Essentially, recommendations to our listeners on how you unplug, Yanis. Like, what are you reading right now? What's your reading recommendation or a movie? For me, today, for you, Yanis, is the Everything Wall by Dena Mattioli. Maybe you've read it already, by this journalist from the Wall Street Journal, and it's about the Amazon's ruthless rise to an everything company.
Well, I have to tell you that, firstly, my major way of unplugging is music. Music buff. I listen to a lot of music, and I play the keyboards badly, but well enough for me to feel totally disembodied from my daily existence, enough to unplug. As for books that I read, I have to read a lot of books that are sent to me for review, and that's not always pleasant. And this is why I fall back on older books, usually ones that I enjoyed in the past and which I reread with fresh eyes. So these days, I mean, I relax with a little bit of Thomas Mann.
Thomas Mann, fantastic. Matteo, what's your unplugged recommendation for our listeners?
I'm plugging a lot by getting ready, reading the biography of both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris ahead of the U.S. elections, and I'm trying to get ready to the big appointment that we have in November in a few days when the U.S. elections. So I'm not really unplugging, to be honest, because these are not readings that they unplug you; they still get your head and your mind into politics and to what's happened next. But they are interesting. They are interesting, definitely, to try to have an understanding of. The people that are on the other side of the oceans. And then, as Yanis was saying, in a way or another, we have to deal with them. So it's interesting to understand their life, their background, and their ideas and their policies.
Indeed. It's hard to do things without the American. I'm actually half American myself, so I guess I tie into that. But that brings us to an end and a conclusion. Yanis, we wanted to thank you a lot for taking the time and chatting with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Yanis.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And solidarity with all those who have to live near the neon lights of the European Union.
Absolutely. And to our listeners who are in the neon lights, or maybe outside, because today is actually a beautifully sunny day, one of those rare ones here in Brussels, are enjoying some sunshine, and we hope you enjoy to listen to this special episode with Yanis Varoufakis, and we hope to see you next time. All the best, and thank you.
Thank you.